Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 149, Some True History, Part 5. Beacon Press book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Fascinating study of Native, U.S., and really world history. This part five, an essential bit, the doctrine of Christian discovery. Discovery and domination, a key part of that, helps to explain in legalistic, in quote, terms, what has gone on and what is going on, and where there's a window of change can happen. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Page or so into the chapter, according to the centuries-old doctrine of discovery, European nations acquired title to the lands they, quote, discovered, end quote, and indigenous inhabitants lost their natural right to that land after Europeans had arrived and claimed it. Under this legal cover for theft, Euro-American wars of conquest and settler colonialism devastated indigenous nations and communities, ripping their territories away from them and transforming the land into private property, real estate. Most of that land ended up in the hands of land speculators and agribusiness operators, many of which up to the mid-19th century were plantations worked by another form of private property, enslaved Africans. Arcane as it may seem, the doctrine remains the basis for federal laws still in effect that control indigenous people's lives and destinies, even their histories, by distorting them. And it originated in a papal bull issued in 1455 that permitted the Portuguese monarchy to seize West Africa. Following Columbus's infamous exploratory voyage in 1492, sponsored by the king and queen of the infant Spanish state, another papal bull extended similar permission to Spain. Disputes between the Portuguese and Spanish monarchies led to the papal-initiated Treaty of Tordesillas, which, besides dividing the globe equally between the two Iberian empires, clarified that only non-Christian lands fell under the discovery doctrine. The doctrine on which all European states relied thus originated with the arbitrary and unilateral establishment of the Iberian monarchy's exclusive rights under Christian canon law to colonize foreign peoples, and this right was later seized by other European monarchical colonizing projects. The French Republic used this legalistic instrument for its 19th and 20th century settler colonialist projects, as did the newly dependent U.S. when it continued the colonization of North America begun by the British. In 1792, not long after the U.S. founding, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson claimed that the doctrine of discovery developed by European states was international law applicable to the new U.S. government as well. In 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Johnson versus McIntosh. That's the one that Newcomb's book focuses on. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Marshall held that the doctrine of discovery had been an established principle of European law and of English law in effect in Britain's North American colonies and was also the law of the U.S. Court defined the exclusive property rights that a European country acquired by dint of discovery. Quote, discovery gave title to the government by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made against all European governments which title might be consummated by possession, end quote. Amazing the level of brainwashing, just level of brainwashing that was instilled in, you know, much of our system today with this taxes and fees and yada yada. Therefore, European and Euro-American discoverers had gained real property rights in the lands of indigenous peoples by merely planting a flag. Indigenous rights were, in the court's words, in no instance entirely disregarded, but were necessarily, to a considerable extent, impaired. Hogwash. No offense to hogs. The court further held that indigenous rights to complete sovereignty as independent nations were necessarily diminished. Indigenous people could continue to live on the land, but title resided with the discovering power, the U.S. The decision concluded that native nations were, quote, domestic dependent nations, end quote. The doctrine of discovery is so taken for granted that it is rarely mentioned in historical or legal text published in the Americas. The UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples, which meets annually for 2 weeks, devoted its entire 2012 session to the doctrine. 3 decades earlier, as indigenous peoples of the Americas began asserting their presence in the UN human rights system, they had proposed such a conference and study. The World Council of Churches, the Unitarian Universalist Church, the Episcopal Church, and other Protestant religious institutions responding to demands from indigenous peoples have made statements disassociating themselves from the doctrine of discovery. The New York Society of Friends, Quakers, in denying the legitimacy of the doctrine, asserted in 2012 that it clearly still has force of law today and is not simply a medieval relic. So that's wonderful to see. The Unitarian Universalist Association. Interestingly enough, I have had some really positive experiences in Unitarian Universalist Church and the Episcopal Church. So I'm much more open-minded. Some of those for poetry events. And I guess the UN meeting or something here is mentioning indigenous partners to a process of honor and healing, often called truth and reconciliation. And further on, the CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, declared the government's characterization of Native American resistance to the U.S. as much like modern-day Al-Qaeda is not only factually wrong, but overtly racist, and cannot present any legitimate legal basis to uphold Mr. Ballou's conviction. In response, the Pentagon's General Counsel issued a letter stating that the U.S. government stood by its precedent. Now, this is a case, a war on terror case, 2011, a Yemeni citizen. Oh yeah, here's what the Captain White wrote. Not only was the Seminole belligerency unlawful, but, much like modern-day Al-Qaeda, the very way in which the Seminoles waged war against U.S. targets itself violate the customs and usages of war. CCR objected to this passage in the government's brief. The court should reject the government's notable reliance on the Seminole Wars of the 1800s, a genocide that led to the Trail of Tears. And this has changed, but the global indigenous cause reached a major milestone in 2007 when the UN General Assembly passed the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Only four members of the assembly voted in opposition, all of them Anglo settler states: the U.S. Empire, Canada, New Zealand. That was my adding the empire in there. U.S., Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. All four, with some embarrassment, later changed their votes to approval. But I have heard that their approval lacks real teeth. In a section called Land Claims, with a large part of indigenous nations' territories and resources in what is now the U.S. taken through aggressive war, outright theft, and legislative appropriations. So I highlighted those: war, theft, legislative appropriations, because that's some of what's going on now with all the just read article by Pepe Escobar about hybrid wars and all these different tactics, the empire going into Latin America and rigging the gasoline prices to try to affect Russia. So there's all this economic warfare that goes on under the radar from what the average, you know, person probably, what the media presents as the physical wars, but you know the results are similar. And Dunbar Ortiz highlights land claims and treaty rights are most central to indigenous people's fight for reparations in the United States. Land claims and treaty rights. And again, mention of the Black Hills, the Sioux, the Lakota refused the award and continued to demand return of the Black Hills. They were offered $106 million, and then years later, that would have been amounted to $757 million. But just they refused to do it because it's not about the money. It's about the sacred land and everything that connects with that. And here's a end of a section here that one of the most impoverished communities in the Americas would refuse $1 billion demonstrates the relevance and significance of the land to the Sioux, not as an economic resource, but as a relationship between people and place, a profound feature of the resilience of the indigenous peoples of the Americas. And again, the theofascism, because she says here the relationship of economic development and indigenous peoples in the U.S. is not a 20th century phenomenon. The collusion of business and government in the theft and exploitation of indigenous lands and resources is the core element of colonization and forms the basis of U.S. wealth and power. By the end of the 19th century, indigenous communities had little control over their resources and their economic systems, etc. And then you throw in the doctrine of Christian discovery, and there you again have the theofascism. And here's a kind of third worldish bit here. The Bureau of Indian Affairs began a program to woo industrial plants to reservations, promising cheap labor and infrastructure improvement. The largest such experiment was that of the giant electronics company Fairchild's assembly plant in the Navajo Nation. Eventually that went out. Indian Self-Determination Act of 1975 validated indigenous control over their own social and economic development, with continuation of federal financial obligations under treaties and agreements. So, you know, some stuff gets done, some stuff gets honored. Native lands west of the Mississippi held considerable resources, 30% of the low sulfur coal in the U.S., 5% of the oil, 10% of the natural gas, and 80% of the uranium. The strip mining and coal and uranium in the Navajo Nation was bad enough. Then a coal gasification plant was established to feed into the Navajo electricity generating plant that sent power to Phoenix and L.A., but provided Navajos with little or none. If you look up Peabody Coal and the Black Mesa Water, Black Mesa Water Rights, I forgot the exact name, but, you know, there you have one of the essences and nutshells of what goes on, not only the raping of Mother Earth, but of the Native people's resources, and then that energy used to fuel the cities of America. And she goes on to casinos. Indigenous gaming operations now constitute $26 billion industry annually that employs 300,000 people, with about half the 564 federally recognized nations operating casinos of various sizes. So there's a lot of bucks going on there, and the U.S. got some dipping their hands in there, you know that. Yeah, the Indian gaming lobby in California, for instance, is second only to the prison guards union in the state. Some of the profits, you know, are helping, say, with educational, housing, hospitals. So again, it's one of those, another mixed bag, where some of the profits are actually helping the people. Some there's corruption, you know, it just depends on reading some more of the, you know, each topic a bit of an in-depth shows some more. And here she has a section, the narrative of dysfunction. The mainstream media and books regularly expose and denounce the poverty and social dysfunction found in indigenous communities. Rates of alcoholism and suicide rate are far higher than national averages and higher even than in other communities living in poverty. In a book of case studies of poverty and neglected sites of deterioration in the U.S., journalist Chris Hedges offered an impassioned account of the Pine Ridge Reservation. He calls them sacrifice zones. There's another one maybe in New Jersey, I think. Dunbar Ortiz continues, as well-meaning and accurate as such portrayals are, however, they miss the specific circumstances that reproduce indigenous poverty and social scarring, namely the colonial condition. As Vine Deloria Jr. and other Native American activists and scholars have emphasized, there is a direct link between the suppression of indigenous sovereignty and the powerlessness manifest in depressed social conditions. Steve Newcomb highlighted that in a recent First Voices radio bit where he was mentioning decolonization as, you know, one of the main things that Native peoples want or need is, and the whole psychology of that is to decolonize. People are like, what can I do? What can I do? But it's also, what can you de-do or whatever you want to call it. But decolonization, that's important. Deloria Jr. explained that for the Sioux, everyone has responsibility and rituals to perform that involve a particular geography. In their case, this means sites in the Black Hills. Quote, some of the holy men up there will say that a lot of the social problems with the Sioux are the result of losing the Black Hills, so you couldn't perform your duties and become a contributor to the ongoing creation. And consequently, people began to fall away, and they started to suffer, and they started to fight among themselves. That's, I mentioned that last show, really a key thing about sort of the distance from the sacred sites, and people start to lose touch with their culture and their ways, and it's like a slow assimilation process. In Bird Medicine, Evan Pritchard's fascinating book about birds, he mentions some studies done with the cell towers, and I think it was like 200 yards or 200 meters, a huge difference between, say, 200 and 300 meters, where at 200, birds were exhibiting signs of, I don't know what you call it, amnesia or Alzheimer's. They were, like, dropping sticks and forgetting what they were doing, whereas about 300 meters, that they were being able to build their nests and do stuff, but too close to these cell towers, and they were just, like, losing touch with their senses. So this is a parallel with what a sacred site means, and what the energy, the battery, the energy. I got some flowers and vegetables for our garden here, and I have them inside for a week till the weather warms up, till the ground warms up. And so as I'm looking at them, saying hello to them and greeting them, and looking and seeing, well, wow, they're staying the same as they are, basically. Because they're in these little pots, and these little pots have a little bit of Mother Earth, and it's like a battery. That was my insight, having them indoors, and it's like Mother Earth is among other things, this is like a huge battery of energy. And when if we lose connection with that energy, what happens? And again, Dunbar Ortiz stretches this to the global view. The effects of continued colonization form similar patterns among indigenous communities throughout the Americas, as well as among the Maori of New Zealand and the Australian Aborigines. And again, the boarding schools, all that stuff, again, it creates cultural disconnect, and all, again, pulling away people from their lands. And here's a little feather in Obama's cap. In March 2013, however, that opposition was overcome. The president and President Barack Obama signed the amended act back into law, a small step forward for Native sovereignty. This is the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. So that's good to help that. And interestingly, on the East Coast, talk about the Haudenosaunee and the Great Law of Peace as where the U.S., some of the U.S. Constitution comes from. But here she mentions, like some other Native nations, the Navajo, the most populous and the one holding the largest land base in the U.S., has never had a constitution. Nearly 60 Native nations adopted constitutions before 1934. Following the Indian Reorganization Act, another 130 nations wrote constitutions according to federal guidelines, but without significant participation of their citizenry. So there's a mixed bag there. And here's an interesting flavor of what a Native constitution sounds like. From 2004 to 2006, the Osage Nation, located in northeastern Oklahoma, engaged in a contentious process of reform that produced a new constitution. The preamble reflects the extraordinary context and content of the new law. We, the, I'll try to pronounce it, Wazazi, known as the Osage people, having formed as clans in the far distant past, have been a people, and as a people, have walked the earth and enjoyed the blessing of Wakanta for more centuries than we truly know. Having resolved to live in harmony, we now come together so that we may once more unite as a nation and as a people, calling upon the fundamental values that we hold sacred: justice, fairness, compassion, respect for and protection of child, elder, all fellow beings, and self. Notice self comes forth there. Paying homage to generations of Osage leaders of the past and present, we give thanks for their wisdom and courage, acknowledging our ancient tribal order as the foundation of our present government, first reformed in the 1881 Constitution of the Osage Nation. We continue our legacy by again reorganizing our government. This constitution, created by the Osage people, hereby grants to every Osage citizen a vote that is equal to all others, and form a government that is accountable to the citizens of the Osage Nation. We, the Osage people, based on centuries of being a people, now strengthen our government in order to preserve and perpetuate a full and abundant Osage way of life that benefits all Osages living and as yet unborn. And that's the quote there. Similarly, in 2009, the White Earth Nation of the Ojibwe people adopted a new constitution. That's some maybe Winona LaDuke's people. And here's the last couple paragraphs of this chapter. She mentioned Gerald Visoner, a writer, and also, as far as I have discovered, there's been a few, but the most prominent haiku poet of Native peoples. I think I've read other ones, but anyway, his are the most prominent. Gerald Visoner, V-I-Z-E-N-O-R, a citizen of the White Earth Nation, best-selling author and leading intellectual, participated in the writing of this constitution, that's the Ojibwe one, explaining the concept of survivance, a word that he coined, I guess, a term he coined. He stresses that it originates in indigenous narratives. Quote, the conventions of survivance create a sense of Native presence over nihilism, nihility, and victory. Survivance is an active presence. It is not absence, deracination, or ethnographic oblivion. And survivance is the continuation of narratives, not a mere reaction, however pertinent. Survivance stories are renunciations of dominance, the unbearable sentiments of tragedy, and the legacy of victimry. So part of his use, I think, what I remember reading, was that like survival sounds like a sort of more short-term type of thing or a specific result, whereas he's putting it in an ongoing long-term sense of survivance. And we might as well read the preamble here. The Anishinaabeg of the White Earth Nation are the ancestors of a great tradition of continental liberty, a Native constitution of families, totemic associations. The Anishinaabeg create stories of natural reason, of courage, loyalty, humor, spiritual inspiration, survivance, reciprocal altruism, and Native cultural sovereignty. We, the Anishinaabeg of the White Earth Nation, in order to secure an inherent and essential sovereignty, to promote traditions of liberty, justice, and peace, and reserve common resources, and to ensure the in- inalienable rights of native governments for our posterity do constitute, ordain, and establish the constitution of the White Earth Nation. Whoever you pronounce it, it's spelled like Anishinaabeg, AABEG. And the last paragraph of this chapter, the doctrine of discovery is dissolving in light of these profound acts of sovereignty. But neither arcane colonial laws nor the historical trauma of genocide simply disappear with time. Certainly not when conditions of life and consciousness perpetuate them. The indigenous self-determination and sovereignty movement is not only transforming the continent's indigenous communities and nations, but also inevitably the U.S. The ways it is doing that are explored in the concluding chapter. Concluding chapter is not that long, but I want to go over it. I don't want to just rush through it, so make this show a little bit shorter, I guess. Finish up part six. Finish up part six of Some True History. So thank you very much for listening. And we'll go out with a, this is from a lecture by John Trudell, but with some nice funky background music. And it's apparently off of some title. The title on the YouTube thing is, I have no country to fight for. My country is the earth. I am a citizen of the world. And this is listed as around 2002, a thought-provoking lecture.
Sometimes I just feel like I'm surrounded in a madness that I really don't get. But it's an acceptable madness to everybody in the madness. We don't know who we are. We don't understand the language we speak. We don't know where we're going. My generation, we did what we could to try to change things, but we missed something. There was something we didn't get. There were certain aspects of reality we didn't recognize because we were emotionally distorted by the imprinting that had happened to our perception of reality. Or who we are. We're human beings. All things of the earth are made up of the same metals, minerals, liquids. So all things of the earth are shapes of the earth, made of the earth. This is our form. We have being, human being. All things of the earth have being, because we are all composed of the same things, have the same relationship to sun, sky, universe. Form is different. We know they can take the uranium, the bone, flesh, and blood of Earth, that is uranium. We know they can take it out of the Earth and put it through a mining refinement process and convert its being into a form of energy that they use to run electrical systems. They do it with fossils. Take the fossils out, put them through the mining refinement process, take the energy from that, and put it into another form of electrical system. We're made of the same stuff going on with us. Our shape is different. They mind the being part of human by how they imprint the perception of reality that they imprint into human consciousness at birth. And then they mind the being part of human through how they program the human to perceive reality. And take that being part of human into a form of energy to run a system. We're fuel. When they do it with the uranium and they do it with the fossil fuel, they leave behind poison and toxic waste. When they do it with the being part of human, it leaves behind poison and toxic waste. And this poison and toxic waste, these are the fears, doubts, and insecurities that become a part of your perceptual reality. And from that point on, your perception of reality is always based upon your inabilities. We manifest our power through our intelligence, and this is done by how we perceive reality. Have you ever had the experience of feeling powerless? And when you're having this experience of feeling powerless, how bad can you make yourself feel? And how does that affect the people around you? Well, see, reality, that is power. It's your personal power. That's how much power you have. So whatever's going on in your reality, if you can do this and affect the people around you, if you can accomplish that, then that means you have power. Whatever's going on, it isn't about you not having power. The reality of the situation is, this is how we have been imprinted to use our power against ourselves. So this is the power of intelligence used chaotically, incoherently, based upon what we've been imprinted to believe. I feel like I'm surrounded in a dimensional reality where nobody's thinking anymore. Everybody's believing. You can't think and believe simultaneously. This is one of those one or the other things. You do one or you do the other, but you can't do them both. The imprinting. Everything is about energy. We project electromagnetic thought. So we're taking that energy and we're putting it into this box, this cage of belief that has no openings. So that energy's got nowhere to go. So it turns into these stresses, and then these stresses manifest, all right, through our fears and our doubts and our insecurities. And in that whole process, we're not thinking clearly. Because we're believing, believing is thinking. But your generation is literally being handed into slavery. The more you chant and rah-rah the freedom word, the further into slavery you're being led. So I'm telling you, it's in your best interest to use your intelligence as clearly and coherently as you can. And don't believe anything. Question everything. Think about everything. Because we've handed you over. Our generation did it because we didn't think things out. We reacted emotionally based on what we believe. We fought a holding battle, so we held our own to a certain degree. And we got some gains here and there, see, but that's all that it was. See, somewhere in here, someone's got to inject clear thinking. Whatever it is that's going on, it can't be outfought. It's never going to happen. But it can be outthought. You have something confronted against you that you need to fight, however the form is, outthink it. See, so this is really about thinking, but we're never encouraged to go that way. We're encouraged to believe and to fight. We're not taught or encouraged to think. I see a lot of human beings that, you know, they aren't really alive anymore. And I think there's something to being alive that's really about alive. I think every day we should remember to live. See, a lot of times we just exist to survive the day. We don't exist, you know, they aren't really alive anymore. And I think there's something to being alive that's really about alive. I think every day we should remember to live. See, a lot of times we just exist to survive the day. We don't remember to really live. See, I don't understand the whole economic thing that's going on, you know, because... So when they jumble this number over here and that number over there, see, all I see is they're enslaving you with debt. That's what I see. See, so no matter how you hide it behind democracy and freedom, and rah, 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 all the stuff, a slave is a slave. And I'm going to tell you this, too. See, when I grew up, they told me, they imprinted in my consciousness why the communists were bad. Because they spied on you. They had your neighbors spy on you. They were police states. You didn't have any rights. They could search you. They could do anything that they want. The state could take the money and it could take the property of the people and everything belong. What's going on here? The very thing they warned me about, I see it emerging. Every election cycle, right? The politicians come out and they tell the voters what the voters want to believe. They tell them what they want to hear. They don't require that these politicians make any sense. See, nobody's thinking clearly on either side. This is all this emotional manipulation, all right? And then there's no clarity. Then people react emotionally, and the chaos just goes on and continues to spread. What is it? People are participating now because they vote for the lesser of the two evils. Hey, hold on here. See, I don't vote either evil and get my support. The governments of the world, these different religious, political differences. There are several major ones. They're not a whole lot, but to me, these are all corrals that they hold all the human beings in as citizens or subjects, where they bring us in, our energy. And they'll look at us as human beings, but just see us as units of energy. It's like these are these, they call them governments and religions, but these are these energy pits they bring our energy into as they feed off of us. They're all being put together to feed the industrial ruling class. There's an industrial ruling class on this planet.